So how food poisoning causes SIBO is really interesting. It's through an autoimmune process. So post-infectious IBS is an autoimmune condition, believe it or not, and not everybody knows that.
Welcome back to the Mastering Your Fertility podcast. The show is all about reclaiming health, enhancing fertility, and preparing for pregnancy. I'm Kristen Cornett, a holistic nutritionist and functional wellness practitioner at Tiny Feet.
And I'm Dr. Haley Nye, a naturopathic doctor and certified nutritionist at Synergy Women's Healthcare in Portland, Oregon. Now, our goal for this show is to educate and empower couples with the knowledge they need to get pregnant, stay pregnant, and have the healthiest baby possible.
Thank you all for joining us today. You're listening to episode 62, where we have the pleasure of interviewing functional digestive health and SIBO expert, Dr. Allison Seebecker, about testing, treatment, and long-term prevention of irritable bowel syndrome and small intestine bacterial overgrowth. In the U.S., 10 to 15% of the population is suffering with IBS, and two-thirds of these cases occur in women. Newer evidence shows that more than 60% of IBS cases are actually caused by SIBO, making this a major issue affecting women's health and ultimately fertility. IBS and SIBO can lead to nutrient deficiencies, food sensitivities, hormone imbalances, autoimmune conditions, and systemic inflammation, all of which impact reproductive health in a negative way. We're excited to have Dr. Seebecker with us today to talk about how you can find out if you have SIBO, what causes it, and how to get effective treatment so you can regain your health and support your fertility. This episode is for anyone who is struggling with their digestive health, especially those with regular symptoms of bloating, gas, abdominal discomfort, constipation, diarrhea, or both. As you might have heard us talk about before, Dr. Haley and I both have personal experiences dealing with different types of SIBO, and we've learned a lot from Dr. Seebecker over the years that has helped us heal both ourselves and help our clients and patients heal as well. If you're curious about the state of your digestive health and how this might be impacting other areas of your health and fertility, we highly recommend downloading our free quiz called Are You Healthy Enough to Get Pregnant, which you can find through the link in the podcast episode description. This quiz will ask you about symptoms in five major health categories that are foundational to optimal fertility, and then give you some simple recommendations on how you can start working toward better health in each category as you prepare for pregnancy. Now, if you've been struggling with your health or fertility for a while and you're sick of trying to figure everything out on your own, it might be time to consider working with someone who can help you get to the bottom of it. If that sounds like you, please consider scheduling a free one-on-one consult with me through Tiny Feet to see how I might be able to help you on your journey. You can find the link to schedule your 20-minute phone consult through the link in the episode description. All right, so let's introduce you to our guest today. Dr. Allison Seebecker is instructor of advanced gastroenterology, as well as former medical director and co-founder of the SIBO Center for Digestive Health at the National University of Natural Medicine. She is IBS faculty for the GI Health Foundation and is the co-founder of the NUNM SIBO Symposium, NUNM GI Conference, and the online SIBO SOS Summits. She has specialized exclusively in the treatment of SIBO since 2010, is an award-winning author, and is the creator of the free educational website SIBOinfo.com, where you can find her homemade elemental diet recipe, SIBO-specific food guide, SIBO symptomatic relief suggestions handout, and more for free. Dr. Seebecker also has online courses available, both for practitioners wanting to learn more about working with SIBO in their practice and for patients who need guidance on their SIBO healing journey. If you're a practitioner, check out the SIBO Pro course, which will walk you through all the ins and outs of addressing SIBO in your practice. You'll learn in depth about underlying causes, testing interpretation, customizable treatment protocols, and relapse prevention. You'll also learn about how SIBO symptoms are generated and the role of SIBO in IBS as well as other diseases. Plus, you'll get desk reference slides, treatment algorithms, and lots of clinical pearls of wisdom from Dr. Seebecker herself. This course is open to all different types of practitioners, both licensed and unlicensed. If you're a patient suffering from SIBO and you want to know how to customize your diet to your individual needs, access the most accurate testing, find the right treatments that will work for your specific type of SIBO, and learn how to prevent relapse, then check out Dr. Seebecker's SIBO Recovery Roadmap course. You can access both courses through the link in the episode description, and they both have special promotional pricing going on right now through February 6th, 2020. So if you're interested in enrolling, definitely don't wait. All right, so without further ado, let's get started on today's episode. All right, welcome, Dr. Allison Seebecker. Thank you so much for joining us today on Mastering Your Fertility. We are really excited to have you.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, we have not talked about this topic in depth for quite some time on the podcast. Today is all about small intestine bacterial overgrowth, and Dr. Haley and I have personal stories about this. For listeners that have not caught those stories, you can find those way back on the podcast in episodes 9 and 10, but we wanted to invite a naturopathic doctor expert on to talk about this with us today. So Dr. Seebecker, tell us a little bit about your background and what made you decide to become a naturopathic doctor.
Well, that's an interesting question. I really feel actually I had a spiritual calling, so to speak, to be a naturopathic doctor. It really was an actual feeling like a lightning bolt sort of that hit me in my body, except it wasn't a real lightning bolt that drew me to it. But I did have a background to bring me towards it. I'd always been interested in alternative medicine, and I had worked for years as a manager of a like a HAVA or wellness department, I guess you call it, in health food store, where we did both the skincare and the supplements. And I was very lucky with the company I worked for. We had trainings every week by many wonderful experts in so many things. So I'd actually received a lot of training. So I had a great interest in it. And somewhere along the line, I just got that calling to go to school. And so, I think one could say that what was behind all of that, though, is because I myself had had digestive issues my whole life. Maybe not my whole life, but certainly starting at around 5. I think I was actually born, from all accounts of my family, with normal digestive function. But you know, I can't say for sure because I was, you know, I can't remember that. But from about 5 years old and on, I had what could have been called IBS, and then I have tested positive, of course, for SIBO. And so when I found out about SIBO, I was very interested because I had been to many, many doctors, like so many people who have chronic conditions, and many naturopaths, and I had been to many really, really excellent doctors. And everything that was tried, that was diagnosed or treated, didn't pan out for me. And so really, I sort of had the sense there was some missing information. And then when, you know, because these were very educated people, there was something that wasn't known. And so then when I found out about SIBO, that fit the bill because no one knew about it. And that's what really, it was new in terms of the linkage with IBS as an underlying cause of IBS. And so that's what really lit a fire under me to become basically a SIBO ambassador or SIBO advocate. And my previous professor of gastroenterology and I teamed up and made a partnership to raise awareness on SIBO. And we've done all kinds of things to raise awareness, and it certainly has worked. And the reason it worked is because other people recognized the validity of this information, right? So, mm-hmm. So that's basically what brought me to it. And my general background is that I am teach advanced gastroenterology at Naturopathic University, where Haley, Dr. Nye, was in my mm-hmm. class long ago. And I started the SIBO annual SIBO symposium. I advised for the SIBOCon or SIBO conference. I created an online SIBO summit with another partner and have an online free educational website on SIBO called SIBO Info. And I started all of those many, many years ago. And now a lot of people don't even know about those things. They can't even find my site because everyone and their brother has a site on SIBO, which is good news.
Well, I have to say that I personally lived on SIBOinfo.com when I first kind of found out about this diagnosis. There weren't as many resources. It wasn't being talked about as much as it is now. And so I personally benefited a lot from the information that you shared and having, mm-hmm. you know, the kind of treatment options laid out and what I could do and, you know, homemade elemental formula and stuff that I could find on there. And so I supported myself quite a bit with that
information. Good. Good. I'm so glad.
Yeah.
So like I mentioned, we have talked about SIBO before on the podcast way back, but for those that haven't listened that far back on the podcast, tell us what SIBO is and what symptoms it usually causes.
Well, I'll say the symptoms. It has the same symptoms as IBS. IBS is for irritable bowel syndrome. You know, a lot of people have these symptoms that I'll mention in a minute and don't even know anything about irritable bowel syndrome or think that they would have it. So the symptoms are abdominal bloating or distension. So when the abdomen swells out specifically after eating, and often it gets worse throughout the day as you eat your meals. So the typical pattern is it's worse by the end of the day. And then by the morning, it might have gone down some, if you're lucky. In other cases, it never goes down. And then there's discomfort or pain in the abdomen, and then either constipation, diarrhea, or some sort of mixture of the two. And then there can be things like excessive burping or farting. There can be nausea, acid reflux, anxiety, and brain fog are very common. What we typically don't see is blood in the stools. That is not a typical symptom of SIBO. And vomiting is not a typical symptom of SIBO, but often people will have nausea. But the core symptoms are really, there's some sort of dysregulation in the bowel movements and bloating. Bloating is sort of the hallmark symptom, and some discomfort. What was the other question? You have to remind me.
The other question was, what is it?
Yeah, thank you. The super important.
Yeah, that thing.
I was going to go off on another track. I'm like, wait, there was something important. Okay, so what it is when bacteria accumulate in the small intestine, and they don't normally do that. So normally we have bacteria that, you know, that we swallow, they're in our environment, they come with our food, and they live in various parts of our gastrointestinal tract. Well, anyway, they normally just move through our digestive tract and down into the large intestine. And that's where we have a lot of bacteria, and they do good things for us, but they are not supposed to be in the small intestine. So it's an unusual circumstance that doesn't quite fit any one category that I think most people are used to thinking of. I think most people will immediately imagine SIBO as an infection, but it doesn't actually fit the pure definition of an infection. So it's not actually an infection. At this time, it is not considered to be technically an infection. So what is it really? It's like a colonization, or like its name sounds, an overgrowth of bacteria in a place they're not supposed to be. And the reason why they're not supposed to be there is we do all of our digestion and absorption of food there. And when bacteria are there, they interfere with that process and cause those symptoms. And our body has all these protections that make sure we don't accumulate bacteria there. That is just not a normal circumstance. So some people actually argue whether or not it's a real condition, because it isn't an infection, right? And so, like, what is this thing? How do we describe it? But it does actually fit the definition of a medical condition, because it incurs a pathophysiological state that is, there's a test for it, you can track it, it has known symptoms, and eradication removes those symptoms. So it's certainly a medical condition.
Yes. Okay. Awesome. Well, that's a great overview, and thank you for clarifying some of those points for us. So let's talk a little bit about some of the most common underlying causes. There are a lot. We know that there are a lot of things that can both cause or contribute to this condition, but just give us an idea of what some of the most common ones are, and, you know, are there certain things that make a person more susceptible to developing SIBO?
Yeah. So the most common cause is actually from food poisoning, which is also known as traveler's diarrhea or stomach flu. And I can explain the full physiology of that, but let me just say the second most common cause is probably adhesions. And so adhesions are like scar bands that can form inside the abdomen. They're there to help us, but then they can actually constrict and compress the small intestine. So this is quite notable, these two factors, because I think most people don't realize that most everyone has a history of having food poisoning of some kind, or, you know, stomach flu or whatever like that. But I think most people don't realize that that has been shown to be the number one underlying most common cause of IBS. And when a gastrointestinal infection like that causes IBS, it has a separate name. It's called post-infectious IBS. Most people have never heard of that, or of this whole link, right? Of this whole link. Now, a lot of people get food poisoning, and it's from a virus, from norovirus. That possibly could lead to SIBO, but that's not the main link here. The main link is bacterial food poisoning. Things like Salmonella, E. coli, Campylobacter jejuni. And so this can help explain why everyone, probably everyone's had food poisoning, but not everybody has IBS, because it's oftentimes it's the viral kind, not the bacterial kind. And also you still may not get it. There's only a certain percent risk, certain percent chance that a person would go on to develop IBS if they had food poisoning. It's not like one-to-one. It doesn't happen one-to-one like that. But it's the biggest risk that there is of getting SIBO and of getting IBS is food poisoning. So before I go on to adhesions, any comments or questions there?
Well, I would say for me, at least, I think I talked about this in my episode, I think episode 10, about when I had food poisoning when I was 21. It was quite awful. I don't know what bacteria I swallowed, but it definitely was like Campylobacter jejuni or something like that.
Something bad.
Yeah, something bad. And then I had surgery when I was 19, as well as laparoscopic surgery, but when I had my right ovary removed. So when you talk about adhesions, which we're going to talk about next, is the most common cause of adhesions is surgery. I would say these risk factors are actually quite common. And just like you were saying, everybody likely can think back of a time that they've had food poisoning. And so hopefully you'll talk a little bit about like, how would you test for that? Is that something? And why does food poisoning cause IBS, post-infectious IBS?
Okay, let's do that first, and then we can go into the testing. But I think you've just said something so important. Honestly, just thinking about the big risk factor of food poisoning and also adhesions, which are universal pretty much after surgery, although not all adhesions will cause SIBO, right there is probably enough to explain how common IBS is and SIBO is, which SIBO is very common. By the way, I didn't give the statistic, but 60 to 70% of IBS is shown to be caused by SIBO. So the majority of it. And then, you know, there are other causes of IBS as well. So how food poisoning causes SIBO is really interesting. It's through an autoimmune process. So post-infectious IBS is an autoimmune condition, believe it or not, and not everybody knows that. So the way it happens is all the bacteria that cause the food poisoning secrete the same toxin, and that's called CDT, and it's the B portion that's the issue. So CDTB is the toxin. They all have it. And what happens is that actually looks very similar to a protein that's on one of our nerve cells that's throughout our small intestine. And that protein is called vinculin, and the nerve cells that it sits on are called ICC cells for short. So what can happen, this is, you know, the process of autoimmunity is it's kind of like friendly fire or mistaken identity. So the body mistakenly identifies the vinculin as the toxin. And so when it mounts a defense against the toxin, it also includes that vinculin. And so then it can start destroying these nerve cells, our own immune system, because it thinks it's the toxin. And so that's the process of autoimmunity. So these nerve cells are very, very important for a certain aspect of movement in the small intestine. That's called the migrating motor complex. And this is actually the number one protection we have in our bodies against getting SIBO. It's there to make sure we move the bacteria through our small intestine. It's called a housekeeper wave, and it's meant to clean up after we eat, basically, like washing the dishes. And so any food debris or any cellular debris and any bacteria gets swept down with this motion. Almost think of it like sweeping or scrubbing or something. And it sweeps them all down to the large intestine. Well, these nerve cells are responsible for that. So they get damaged, and now we can't do that movement. And so then we simply have stasis or stagnation, and bacteria accumulate. Like, imagine a flowing river versus, you know, like a stagnant pond or like a river that's backed up. So that's the situation of how it causes it. And it's really incredible. I always like to give acknowledgement that we know this, because this was only figured out, you know, not that long ago, like within the last 15 years, 10 to 15 years. And it's the work of Dr. Pimentel, who's the lead researcher on SIBO. And thankfully, he's explained this all. So now we know why this is happening. We saw it happening. We didn't know why. So that's why. Mm-hmm. So next, let me just describe some of the testing specifically for this, because this is very important. And then we'll talk about all SIBO testing. But there is a test now that Dr. Pimentel developed to figure out if you have SIBO or IBS, because in this case, they're the same thing, from food poisoning. And we call it the IBS blood test, and there's several different labs that have it, but he invented it, and he has now, he's made two versions of it. He's made an updated version that is more effective at detection, and it's called the IBS SMART test. And it's a blood test, and what it does is it checks for antibodies against that toxin, CBTB, and the protein, vinculin. And so there's a lot of different ways you could use this test. It was originally invented to be used as a screening test in the primary care doctor's office. You have symptoms that are consistent with IBS, and the doctor's trying to figure out, might you have IBS? There has never been an actual test for IBS. This is the first real biomarker for IBS, at least for 60 to 70% of it. Because again, that same statistic is the same amount of food that we think food poisoning causes IBS. So you can go and get this test to just see, do I have IBS? Because if it's positive, then you know you have this. You know you have IBS, you know you have SIBO, and you know it came from food poisoning. And the test was developed to distinguish between IBS and IBD, inflammatory bowel disease. And the test for IBD is a colonoscopy. And so the idea here, which is, you know, it's a scope, and you have to, you know, spend a few hours to get this test, and there are risks. So the idea with this is you could get this blood test, and particularly if you were young with no other risk factors of having inflammatory bowel disease, it would spare you the colonoscopy, spare you that risk and expense, because now we would have this diagnosis. So that's the first way this test can be used. Second is, if it's positive, depending upon the results, you can get a sense of your prognosis. So if both of those markers are positive, okay, they're both positive. But sometimes people send the test is positive. And by the way, that's a 98% likelihood that you have IBS. So incredibly good stats on this test. If you have only the CDTB positive, then that is a good prognosis. If the vinculin is not positive, it means you actually haven't developed the autoimmunity, or at least that's not showing on the test. If we're going to believe it's true, which we should with our tests, that means you don't have the autoimmune piece, and that's good. That means you're likely to resolve over this, you know, within maybe months. Like you have a much better prognosis. If that is negative, but the vinculin is positive, then you know you have the autoimmunity, and there is no known cure for this at the time, when you have this post-infectious IBS with the autoimmune picture. So this test is very helpful to know where you are in this picture. What is your prognosis? Now, the sort of the third way that you can use this test is once you've already done the regular SIBO test, which I can describe next, it's to help you figure out what your cause is. Did you get your SIBO from food poisoning? Because not everybody remembers having food poisoning. And food poisoning can just be diarrhea. It may not have vomiting and might not even be very, very bad diarrhea. So you may not remember it. And this test could show, well, were you exposed? And is this the cause? So I think this is an amazing and extremely important test that nobody much knows about yet. And for people listening, you can ask for this test at your doctor's, and it's called IBS SMART. There are other companies that offer it, but that I'm recommending that because I believe it's probably the most effective with the most updated from Dr. Pimentel. Mm-hmm. Now, yeah. Before I go on, anything you want to interject here?
Oh, I think it's great that we have a screening tool that is, I guess, more conventionally diagnostic than what we've had for IBS in the past, which is more, we can't identify some other cause of your digestive issues, so we're going to give you this diagnosis of exclusion, essentially, to tell you we don't really know what's wrong with you, so we're going to label you as IBS. And I think that's really frustrating for patients. I mean, Haley, that was your initial diagnosis, was just being told that you had IBS, right? And that was, oh, we've tested for other things and can't find what it is that's wrong with you, so we're going to label you this way. Having something that is more diagnostic than that and gives us more concrete information about what has actually happened, that's mm-hmm. awesome. I love it.
Yeah, so I have a question about that because I did the IBS SMART test after I went to your talk in October. I was like, I'm going to finally do that. So I did it. And mine is very borderline. I was actually trying to look for it on my email, but couldn't find it. It's like points away from being positive. It's so borderline. So what would you do in that situation? Are you thinking like there's a super mild?
I could look it up right now, but there was actually a level at which the doctors, the experts who were doing these studies felt was a borderline, and they were sort of kind of calling it positive. And I can look up in my file for you, but basically it might have still been positive then. And do you know, you may not want to share, but do you know if you had both positive or one or the other?
I think just one, and that's why I'm trying to find it, because I can't find which one it was.
Well, see, this
so
is
maybe
really,
by the time of the end of the recording, I'll find it.
You'll have it up. This is interesting. And, you know, this kind of brings up a different point about lab testing is that, you know, we have to decide for all of our labs, we have to decide on like a reference range and a cutoff or when we're going to call something positive. Mm-hmm. But that's not necessarily that positive or negative doesn't mean, yes, you have all these symptoms or no, you don't have any of these symptoms, particularly in the case when you're borderline, you know, you might be on your way to positive or you might have symptoms at that level, even though we haven't officially called that a positive result. So just, you know, and it's that's true for all lab tests, not just this.
Really, really true. I mean, that's in particularly in functional medicine, you know, that's a major emphasis is looking at low and high within what's normal. And is that actually borderline? And it's something that takes some good skill and interpretation. So, you know, it's a good segue into the next part of testing, which is, you know, so for a person who's listening, if they're at all suspecting, might I have SIBO, these are two tests they could consider doing. If you run the blood test, you know, it's very simple, right? You know, it's all you have to do is get a blood draw unless you're very have like anxiety around that. It's simple. If that test is positive, then you, okay, you know, but then you would probably still want to go on and get the standard test for SIBO because it helps give us information to guide us for treatment. If you got the blood test and it was negative, you then for sure would want to go on and get the regular test for SIBO because SIBO can be caused by many things other than food poisoning. I didn't mention all these other things. I've really just mentioned the two main ones. But let me talk about the test. So it's a breath test, and you use either lactulose or glucose for this breath test. And I recommend 3-hour breath test. Sometimes it's done as a 2-hour, and it's checking two gases right now, hydrogen and methane, although there'll be a third gas that that test will be available commercially, hopefully coming soon, and that's hydrogen sulfide. And these are the three gases that we have that bacteria make that can cause these symptoms and cause SIBO. And so we sort of have these three subtypes, hydrogen, methane, and hydrogen sulfide, and actually they can be mixed together. And so another common type we have is having both hydrogen and methane mixed together and positive. And what we see is that they correlate with the bowel movement pattern usually. So hydrogen and hydrogen sulfide with diarrhea and methane with constipation. So anyway, this test is not that hard of a test to do. There is a preparatory diet that's done the day before the test, and then you fast overnight. The prep diet is a low carbohydrate diet. It can be a little bit difficult for vegetarians or vegans, but there's ways around that. And then an overnight fast, and then in the morning you take a sample of your breath by breathing into like a tube type of situation that's given to you. You can do it at home or you can go into a lab to do it. Most people do it at home with a kit. And then you drink the solution. And the solution is meant to actually feed the bacteria so that they will make gas. So we can test the gas in the breath. And then you just continue breathing for the next 2.5 hours, basically, or 3 hours. And that's it. You mail it off and we get the results. So the breath test is extremely helpful because with it, based on how high the gas is, we have a sense of how many numbers and rounds of treatments we're going to need to use. And we'll get into treatments in a minute, but there are three main treatments that target reducing the bacteria or killing the bacteria. And two of them can only get rid of so much gas at a time. And so we often have to do multiple rounds. A third treatment, and that one's elemental diet, has the opportunity to get rid of more gas at once. And so that might cut the amount of rounds you need short, depending upon how high your gas is. The gas does not always correlate with the severity of the symptoms. But what it tells us is more about, our treatment and what we're gonna do with that. And so the other thing we're looking for in the test is which gases are present, because that also changes our treatment. We need different treatment when there's methane present versus not. So that is a key thing where many practitioners still are not educated on that, and they give the treatment for just the hydrogen type, but the person has the methane, which often correlates with constipation, almost always does. And they have an unsuccessful treatment, and they say this, both the doctor and the patient say this whole SIBO thing's bunk. And it's because they don't know the proper information of what treatment is needed. So that's a little bit about the test.
Yeah, that's helpful. And I think when we talked about SIBO, we did talk about the 3-hour lactulose breath test. That is the best test, really, to identify, making sure that we're doing the full 3 hours, just because as we're taking these breath samples over time, what we're measuring is the gas that's coming from the sugar as it's moving through the digestive system. And so there's a time cutoff at which we are likely that solution is moving into the large intestine, where you're supposed to have a lot of bacteria, where there should be a lot of fermentation of the carbohydrate. So it's important to do the 3-hour because it helps us see, it helps us kind of map the small intestine a little bit better, as opposed to glucose, which is absorbed higher in the small intestine. So you don't get as much of information about whether or not that SIBO might be hanging out lower down in the small intestine. Your small intestine is pretty long. So
it's very, very helpful. It really gives us a lot more information that as a practitioner, we really need and want. So why cut it short? You know, I really don't fully understand it. Like if we're going in for a breath test, you know, I guess maybe it adds a little bit of expense on for the lab equipment. And, you know, so it's an extra hour of your time. Like, why not do it so we can get the most information? I really don't understand the benefit in cutting it short. So, and I agree, lactulose is much better. So this is an important issue. In the United States, at least, we lactulose requires a prescription. It's a prescription laxative, basically, although it doesn't necessarily work as a laxative in everybody doing this test. People who have diarrhea, I don't think need to be afraid to take the test. It may do that. It may not. There's ways that we can help with that. But it gives us the best information. The thing of it is that anybody, any patient can order their own breath test that's glucose. You can do that because it's not prescription. But if it's negative, then you still would need to do a lactulose test because the glucose hasn't properly assessed the whole intestine. So there's some issues here between what substrate you use. There is actually also a couple of labs now are offering, through a special circumstance, patients can order their own lactulose breath tests through them. And I have those listed on SIBO Info under resources testing. And I mention it simply because there are a lot of people who have doctors that are uneducated on SIBO and are not willing to learn and refuse to order the test for them. Mm-hmm. And so when we get into circumstances like that, you know, we need some empowerment. And, you know, in cases like that, patients can order their own test and, you know, bring it back to their doctor. And, you know, of course we can glibly say, well, they need to find a new doctor, but that can be difficult.
Yeah. And that's hard to know. Is your next doctor going to be that open? And then you get into the situation where you feel like you're having to pre-interview physicians to see whether or not they're going to take your situation seriously. And you know, I've been in that situation looking for a doctor myself. And it is, you know, when you have a full-time job and you're busy, you have a lot of things to do and you're like, okay, how long do I have really to spend interviewing physicians to take this condition seriously that I already have lab evidence is a problem for me. So talk a little bit about, before we kind of move on to the treatment stuff, talk a little bit about some of the other underlying factors that might be contributing to SIBO, and also maybe just a note on some of the conditions, health conditions that are associated with SIBO.
So we really have a multitude of conditions that can lead to SIBO. There are other diseases and circumstances that can basically inhibit the migrating motor complex. Or the other thing we're really concerned about is things that can cause like a partial obstruction to block the flow of the bacteria through there. So first going to the migrating motor complex, well, actually, let me not separate it that way. I'll just mention various diseases. I won't separate it out by what they're doing underneath. So things like hypothyroid, diabetes, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which many people think is rare, but isn't. It's actually not rare at all. Lyme disease and co-infections, gastroparesis, which is slow stomach emptying. these are some diseases, immune deficiency diseases, liver diseases, highly linked with actually as a causal agent of SIBO. Things like hypochlorhydria, so too little stomach acid, is not been shown to be a main cause of SIBO. It is a very, very important risk factor, building up in risk. Parkinson's disease, parasites, which we were talking about before we started, gallbladder disease, the list just starts going on and on. Then there's inflammatory bowel disease, very, very common to lead to SIBO. And all sorts of diseases that can have structural issues like endometriosis, which I'm sure is something you all talk about a lot on your podcast. It's very common to get SIBO from endometriosis, both from adhesions that can form, as well as the endometrial tissue, which can cause a partial obstruction when it swells, depending upon where it's located. Pelvic inflammatory disease as well. So the list just gets longer and longer. Then there's like medications like opiate narcotic painkillers, they slow motility. Proton pump inhibitors can decrease the acid. They can increase risk. Antibiotics. Many people feel they got their SIBO from antibiotics, and we were always confused as to what that actually was doing. And then out came a pilot study showing it slowed the motility in the stomach and small intestine. So
interesting. That's really interesting. What's the, I mean,
not that, and it was a pilot study, so I have no other information. Yeah. I don't know which antibiotics for how long, how, I know none of that.
So we don't know the mechanism behind why it's doing that. Oh, that's really fascinating. Okay.
I was, to me, this was one of the biggest like ding, 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 ding. And I think for anyone who's interested in SIBO, I put out a quarterly newsletter. So just 4 times a year. And I put all the new studies that have been done, and I almost always call out something of interest. And I called this out in my newsletter. I was like, oh my God, we now have some vital information. And then, you know, as Dr. Nye was mentioning, we have surgery, you know, so abdominal or pelvic surgery. Very, very common cause of SIBO for so many people. Also abdominal radiation therapy. And another very common cause would be traumatic brain injury. Mm-hmm. Very common that the gastrointestinal consequences of traumatic brain injury are very well documented, actually, of actually reducing motility. And we are now said to have an epidemic of traumatic brain injury. And just before I leave that, you don't need to hit your head to have had a traumatic brain injury. It's about the brain moving rapidly within the skull. It's a process. So it can take time to develop. So it's not like you had the event and now it's all over with. So I just wanted to mention those things because really awareness needs to be brought up about that. Mm-hmm. And that's probably enough. Now, of course, I didn't mention stress. Stress, we know, contributes to all diseases negatively, right?
Yes.
Stress is an important risk factor. Usually the stress is in the presence of something that has already disturbed the terrain, and it's disturbing the terrain more. I myself personally have only ever seen one case, not to say there's not more, just from my experience, of stress only induced SIBO. So I believe that's pretty rare. What I think is common is that there are all these other risk factors causing a predisposition. And what I have seen commonly, actually very commonly, is there's often about a 2-week period of acute stress that is the final straw that breaks the camel's back, so to speak. Mm-hmm. That's in a lot of people's case histories that I have seen. So, and stress, we know, is important to handle for all kinds of reasons. It actually inhibits the migrating motor complex. It actually inhibits hydrochloric acid secretion, enzyme secretion, and we could go on and on. So we know that, but what is important to distinguish here is that for somebody, like, I think what's important is if somebody has IBS symptoms, it's important to, the first thing, to look at stress. And that's like your absolute, I consider first line therapy, lifestyle and diet, right? Mm-hmm. So the very first thing you do, you know, if you've got headaches and you're drinking 10 Diet Cokes a day, I hope nobody's going to sue me because I said Diet Coke, whatever. You know, that could be the cause of your headaches. Maybe stop drinking that, right? So obviously we have to look at these things first. But if you've done that and you still have IBS symptoms, it's important that we don't blame IBS or SIBO on stress, meaning it's all in your head and there isn't something physical there. So we mm-hmm. need to both stress the importance of stress in as a contributing factor to disease, but not blame away something that can have, there could be an adhesion or endometriosis that needs addressing, causing a bacterial backup. So we have to consider both of these things.
Well, what's interesting about that too, is that your body perceives stress from a number of other things besides just like psychological or emotional stress, right. Like having some sort of hidden chronic infection or a parasite or nutrient deficiencies. Like all of these things are perceived by the body as a stressful situation and are going to influence your production and release of stress hormone into the system. So this is not just like, oh, you're overworking yourself and causing SIBO. It could be, hey, you have something physiological going on inside your body that is creating not only dysfunction in that organ system, but also increasing the body's stress response, mm-hmm. which is going to exacerbate the whole situation in the GI tract.
Yep.
I think it's important to also note that exposure to environmental toxins, things like that, through your food, through perfumes, hairsprays, lotions, you know, that's also a source of stress for your body and your liver. And if your liver is really caught up trying to deal with all that, it's not going to be able to, you know, have optimal digestion, and that is going to be a risk factor as well.
Well, and also, you know, SIBO by its very nature has, it's a bacterial accumulation and overgrowth. Gram-negative bacteria have LPS. You've probably talked about this on your podcast before, but stands for lipopolysaccharide, and it's a aspect of bacteria that's recognized by the immune system. And our immune system gets upset when it sees that there, thinks there's, you know, obviously there's too many bacteria here. And LPS has a myriad of negative effects in the body. So SIBO by its very nature, if SIBO is there, will have excessive LPS. In fact, we think that's the main mechanism that's causing the anxiety that we see so commonly in SIBO. And that's another interesting thing to point out. Some people have mild GI symptoms, a little, but mild, but have strong anxiety. And that can actually be due to SIBO. People do not typically think that something like SIBO, like, oh, you have anxiety, I should be thinking about SIBO, right? That is not the first thing that you think about, and that's fine, but it needs to be considered if the anxiety cannot be handled or dealt with. So anyway, the liver gets overwhelmed and can't detoxify all this LPS, and then it goes out to the rest of the body and has effects.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, drawing the connection between gut and mental health is really important, and inflammation seems to be one of those primary mechanisms that's connecting what's happening in the gut to what's happening in the brain. And LPS is an inflammatory molecule. So if you have a lot of that you're producing, that's going into the body, causing inflammation, that can lead to a number of different effects aside from mental health. But anxiety is really common in my clients, and a lot of them are dealing with gut dysfunction in some capacity. So mm-hmm. very important to note there. So we took a little detour before we talked about treatment. So I think that's probably where we're at now, is talking about treatment options. There are some conventional options, and then there are a couple of different more naturopathic functional medicine type of options. So why don't you give us a quick overview on those?
Well, if we're talking about treatment, I do just want to recognize there's, I would say, three main layers to think about. There's controlling symptoms, which I think those of us in alternative medicine think poorly of, because we always want to go deeper than that. But there are times where we need to bring those things in, particularly in chronic cases. So I just want to mention there's that layer that needs to be considered. If we go one layer deeper than the symptoms, for SIBO, we can treat the bacteria. We can try to eliminate the bacteria. And when we eliminate the bacteria, by focusing on eliminating the bacteria, we can then sort of hopefully get to most or all of the symptoms, right? So that's going to be more effective. But why are the bacteria there? Then underneath that is the underlying cause. And so that's going to be the deepest layer of treatment. And that is going to be beyond the scope of this discussion, because that's okay, treating diabetes, treating other parasites, treating all these other things, right? So I just wanted to put that in a frame here. So when we talk about treating the bacteria, it's the middle layer, and it may result in like long-term like cure, so to speak, or it may not, and because of the underlying causes. And so just briefly, I never mentioned the statistics on that. It's thought that about 2/3 of SIBO cases are chronic, and one third are not chronic. Now, are you hearing this noise in my room?
Very slightly.
Yeah, very slightly.
It's okay.
Okay, good. Okay.
We'll ignore it.
But there's work being done on my house. So.
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah. So anyway,
we had a leaf blower in Haley's audio a couple weeks ago.
Okay. Well, yeah, there's some work being done about it. So anyway, that's an unfortunate statistic. But it just all the more brings us to realize we have to try and figure out why the SIBO is there and work on the underlying cause. Because for situations like that, people will relapse. And we'll just have to, you know, we'll have an endless cycle of needing to treat the bacteria. One other thing I want to say is that there are some causes of SIBO that are at least currently incurable, not known. Like, for instance, systemic sclerosis or scleroderma is a progressive autoimmune condition that has no known cure at this time and highly, highly leads to SIBO. So if you have a patient like that or someone is like that is listening, you know, then for them, they will cycle through their bacteria killing treatments to get their SIBO gone for months at a time, sometimes even 6 months at a time, and then they treat again. So it all depends upon where you're at. So now the treatments. We can use pharmaceutical antibiotics, herbal antibiotics, or elemental diet. So just briefly, pharmaceutical antibiotics that we use for SIBO are, the main one we use is called rifaximin, or the brand name is Xifaxan. And it's a very different antibiotic than others because it doesn't absorb systemically and it also has anti-inflammatory properties. And it also actually has these properties they call eubiotic because it can actually increase the amount of good probiotic bacteria in the large intestine. It's the only pharmaceutical antibiotic I've ever heard of that can do that. So it's very, very different than regular antibiotics. And so how lucky for at least for the people that have SIBO that they get that special antibiotic that helps. So it primarily works in the small intestine and it doesn't absorb into the body. So it works just where we need it to. So that's the main antibiotic. Problem is it's often not covered on people's insurances. And when you have to pay out of pocket, it's hideously expensive. So what a lot of people do is they go to Canadian pharmacies. And when you do that, I mean, online. And when you do that, there are options that you can get the real brand, the actual brand of that from other countries that costs still a lot of money, but less. Or people get these a generic. And those are very inexpensive. But the problem here is that we have a difference of opinion in the field. Many practitioners have found these generic, inexpensive rifaximin to not actually be effective. Hmm. Maybe it depends upon the sort of generic brand you're buying. So I just wanted to mention that. Some doctors use those and find good success and others have not found success. So there seems to be a little bit of an issue here. So we have a logistical issue in that if the insurance isn't covering someone's, it's very, very expensive out of pocket and people run into trouble. And this is a shame because this antibiotic is extremely effective and not harmful, right? Of course, anybody can react. People can have die-off and anybody can react to anything. Of course, you always have to say that. I certainly see people reacting. Now, if a person has hydrogen bacteria, that's what we use. But if they have methane, we then have to add to it either neomycin or metronidazole. And those are typical antibiotics. Neomycin is actually maybe slightly less of a typical antibiotic because it stays in the intestinal tract. Mm-hmm. But they don't have all these wonderful special properties like rifaximin does. So they're typical antibiotics, but they seem to target the bacteria, which are actually archaea, that make the methane. It's a different class of microbe, and they need a different antibiotic. So we have to use the two together. So it's either rifaximin and neomycin or rifaximin and metronidazole. Now, if we go over to the herbs, what we typically use for the hydrogen is we use berberine, which comes from herbs like golden seal and Oregon grape. But you can buy formulas online that just say like berberine complex or berberine, you know, 500 or whatever, just various, you know, where they're using two or three of the berberine containing herbs. So we use berberine, we use oregano, and we use neem. Those work wonderfully for the hydrogen. For the methane, we need, just like when we're doing pharmaceutical antibiotics, we have to add in these other herbs. And we currently have about two options. One is allicin, which is an ingredient that is extracted out of garlic. And here I think the brands can make a difference because garlic oil or whole garlic or aged garlic that is very fermentable and can actually sort of worsen a SIBO patient, trigger them and worsen them. So what we typically use is a brand called AlliMed. It's a company called AlliMax, and they have several different potencies. The one we tend to use is AlliMed. There's another company that's put a competing product out, NFH, I believe it's called. They have an Allicin sap that a lot of my colleagues have used with success. However, you need so many more pills of it. It's a lower potency in per pill. But I'm hearing reports of effectiveness. So we add that to one of the other herbs typically. So, you know, we would do for methane. So, and by the way I typically do this is I typically use two herbs at a time when I'm treating. So for hydrogen, it would be either oregano and neem oregano and berberine, or neem and berberine. You just switch them up, right? You used to. For the methane, it's any one of those three, berberine, oregano, or neem, plus the allicin. There is another option, which is called atrantil. This is a small, three-herb blend. And this works a little differently. Instead of killing the bacteria, it has some of that action, but it primarily works by inhibiting an enzyme in the archaea that make methane gas, so they can't make that gas. And so that's another option, is atrantil, that you can use either alone or with one of these herbs. You can also mix some of the herbs with the pharmaceutical. So you could use like rifaximin and allicin in case you didn't want to use the neomycin or the metronidazole. So these are our options there. Now, what a lot of docs do is they don't do this sort of two herb thing. They just grab, you know, like a big herbal antimicrobial sort of product off the shelf, of which they often have many that they like and use, and they use one of those. And that also works. So those are formulas that are targeted at viruses, parasites, yeast, and bacteria. So many doctors will do that as well. The issue is if you have the methane, you just need to be cognizant to either notice how much garlic is in that product, like whole garlic, and maybe don't use it. It might aggravate your patient. Or you, if you are the patient. And if it's not there, you need to add that if they have the methane. And there are, you know, there are other herbs. There was a famous study done by our colleague, Dr. Mullen and his team. And they used these two formulas one by Metagenix. It's Candibactin AR and BR. That's very similar to what I just described, although, different potency. And then there's Biotics FC-cytyl and Dysbiocide were used in that same study. Personally, I have found FC-cytyl and Dysbiocide to not work as well, even though in this study they were shown to work as well. And where I find them to work is, and this will be interesting because I know Kristen, you had used this product, is in what I call the unusual patient. So what I mean is the other herbs that I just mentioned or the other antibiotics don't work well. And then if they're not working well, if we switch over to FC-cytyl and Dysbiocide, oftentimes we'll be able to see some effect. So that's how I usually see that going. So I never start with the FC-cytyl and Dysbiocide. So those are the herbs. Now, the last thing is the elemental diet. This is a drink, and you drink it in place of your meals. And the idea behind it is you're trying to starve the bacteria but feed the person. And why this would happen is because you're taking your nutrients in pre-digested form so they don't need any time for digestion, and they can just absorb as soon as they hit the stomach and the top of the small intestine and hopefully absorb into our body before getting a chance to feed the bacteria, and that sure seems to work. So there are commercial formulas available. There's a new one that just came out. I put in my newsletter that came out a couple weeks ago, and I cannot remember the name because it's so new. It's by VitaAid, and they have, I think, two versions of it. They do a low carb and a high carb, which is great. And then there's Physician's Elemental Diet by Integrative Therapeutics. And then there's the standard commercial formula that the studies were done on, which is called Vivinex Plus. I also like to use Neocate Junior. I've used that for years because it's flavored. So Vivinex Plus is not flavored and it tastes terrible.
It's meant for tube feeding.
Yeah, it's really, 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 really bad because there's amino acids in it, and amino acids are very bitter and they often cause a gag reflex. So I'm really not kidding. It's very, very awful tasting.
I have not tasted the Vivinex, but I have made my own elemental formula before and done the free form amino acids. Don't do it if you have another option.
or if you have a strong gag reflex.
Yeah.
Lots and lots of patients do it. And they're just like, I'm telling you, I have patients that are like, what's everyone complaining about? You know, there's different walks of life here. So anyway, and so those are some options. All of the commercial ones that I mentioned, except Vivinex, are flavored. And then the homemade is the recipe I made years and years ago, because we didn't have these other options. These formulas have all been made, and Vivinex is expensive, and it was too expensive for my patients. So I made a homemade recipe. So you can also follow the homemade recipe. What's nice about the homemade recipe is not the taste, because there's no flavoring, but you can alter your ratios of things, and you can switch products around in case you have food sensitivities. So they all work equally effective. It's a difficult treatment to do because you aren't eating, you know, you're not chewing, it's eating meals. You're drinking instead. You're drinking a liquid, and that's hard. It's really a form of fasting, and I think it's best approached from that mindset, sort of from a spiritual perspective, a cleansing perspective. It's a medical program you're on, and if you have that positive frame of mind, that can help, because it's you know, challenging to do it. But it's very effective. And one of the main reasons we do this is because it can lower more gas than the other two methods. So the other two methods, herbs and antibiotics, we typically see, this is average, of course you can see exceptions, somewhere around a 30 part per million reduction of gas per treatment round. So treatment round is typically 2 weeks for pharmaceutical antibiotics, 4 weeks for herbal antibiotics. Those can be continued a little longer, and then you sometimes get more gas down. Elemental diet is also 2 weeks. So within 2 weeks, we will typically see somewhere around a 70 part per million gas decrease if it's going to be effective for somebody. So that's the main reason that we do it. If somebody has, you know, 100 part per million gas on their SIBO test, they could choose elemental diet and in 2 weeks have that test negative, possibly. Whereas possibly, right? Because not everybody works for everybody. But if they choose herbal or pharmaceutical, then they might need 4 rounds or something like that. So on average, I would say it's a rare person that chooses elemental first. They would rather go through multiple rounds of antibiotics and herbal antibiotics. And almost always, if you've heard me ever speak before, you'll hear that this is what I always hear. People say, I wish I'd just done elemental to begin with, but they all, yeah, Dr. Nye feels like that, but tell me, you can say if you feel this way, but then they all say, but I wasn't ready and I needed to go through all those rounds to be ready to do the elemental, but gosh darn, I wish I'd just done it anyway. Mm-hmm. So now your comments.
No, that's, I agree with that. I mean, I did a round of physician sanctioned herbal antimicrobials. I did a round on my own, and then I was like, okay, this is getting ridiculous. I'm really sick of this process. So I did homemade elemental. I did the high fat version. I don't think that worked well for me for a number of different reasons, but then I ended up having access to physician's elemental formula the second time I did the elemental diet. I kind of liken it to drinking cake frosting every day, like 6 times a day for 2 weeks.
That's could be worse.
So it could be worse if you're like sensitive to sugar. Yeah. So I feel like digestively, which is funny because, you know, you're not supposed to be really doing a whole lot of digesting, but when you're making your own and you're experimenting with the fat sources that you can use, I just don't feel like that worked well for me to do the high fat version when I did my homemade elemental, but the higher carbohydrate version, which the commercial formulas typically are just higher in carbohydrate, that was difficult for a different reason. That was difficult from a blood sugar handling perspective. So I had to really stay on top of the timing for the shakes, which was a little bit challenging given what was going on in my life at the time. So, I mean, there are pros and cons to each choice for treatment. And, you know, you're not necessarily going to get it 100% right for every person the first time. Mm-hmm. It can take a little bit of experimentation. So that's why I think it's important to have conversations like these where we're resetting the expectations around SIBO. So it's not just like, oh, you knock out the gas for 2 weeks and it's over and it's done. It's like, okay, it could be more complex than that. And there may be some chronic issues that are underlying this condition and you need to be prepared for that.
Yeah, I think that's really important because when we first were learning about SIBO back in 2012, 2013, at school is that it really did feel like, okay, we're just going to do this round of treatment and, you know, the numbers are going to drop and you're going to feel so much better.
Learn that from my class.
Nope. Your class was more like 3 years later, I think.
Okay, good. I'm like, oh my lord, when we actually I didn't teach you well.
When we learned some things, and then there was, you know, a lot of clinical experience where we're like, ooh, yeah, that's actually not what's happening. So, and then what really struck me too is when you were, I think you already mentioned this, but this last conference that I saw you speak at in October, when you mentioned the stats on one third can resolve SIBO fairly quickly with a round or two, and then two thirds of people who are suffering with IBS or this chronic SIBO picture, it takes multiple rounds and oftentimes they're going to relapse. And that's why when you were talking earlier about the three layers of SIBO, and we're talking about treating it as the second layer, and then the third layer is really trying to figure out what caused it in the first place. Like, so for example, if some of our listeners have or suspect that they have endometriosis and they are also suffering from SIBO, that getting, you know, Mayan abdominal massage or adhesion breakup and like really doing a lot of physical therapy around that, I think could be extremely helpful for not only experiencing your symptoms, such as the bloating and the pain that you're experiencing, but also just resolving those symptoms for a longer period of time.
Well said. I agree with all of that. Now, I have to pop in here quickly and say that I need to mention two things in treatment before we end. And I know we're going long, but I didn't talk anything about the hydrogen sulfide, and that's because it's newer. And different doctors who focused on SIBO, like myself, have had to figure this out on our own, in our own clinics, because we haven't had too much to guide us. You know, what I did is went in and just read studies and used those on hydrogen sulfide to help me. Really, that's what any other of my colleagues are doing. And so we're all sort of independent of each other, trying to figure out what to do. The hydrogen sulfide information is going to be forthcoming fairly soon. I believe this spring in the, at the big, so spring 2020 at the big GI conference, Dr. Pimentel will be putting out new information. But so it's not as clear what we need to do, but I can tell you what the studies have shown, and I've had good results with, is bismuth. So kind of like what's in Pepto-Bismol, bismuth actually sort of like sequesters hydrogen sulfide gas and can bind it. Basically, it binds it and then can, it can be removed. Not as much about killing the bacteria, similar to how Atrantil works. And so that's an option. You can do it alone. You can do it with antibiotics. So you can try the standard antibiotics for SIBO. You can add the bismuth. Herbally, something that I found to be fairly helpful is oregano. You do need to do the oregano in pretty high dose. So the one that I typically use is ADP by Biotics, because it's in a tablet, a dry tablet form. And I found that goes a little easier on people's stomachs than oil in a capsule. And so of that product for the hydrogen sulfide, we're using sort of an old, chiropractic, treatment that was used for something else, but we found it to work. And so we start with five tablets, three times a day for 10 days. And then we switch to three tablets, three times a day for the remaining 20 days. So we do a month, you know, if tolerated, but we tend to need to go higher. So I have found that clinically to be effective. There's also a low sulfur diet. I find sometimes that helps and sometimes it's not needed. And there are various other things that can help, like molybdenum and butyrate, and there's some probiotics that have been shown to help. So hydrogen sulfide is very important, because we think now it's going to explain a lot of the things we have seen clinically, but that were mysterious to us. Mm-hmm. I don't want to take all the time to describe those things, and it's rather actually advanced, but anyway, I'm really looking forward to all this information coming out, and the testing should be coming out soon. And then the one other thing I have to mention for treatment is after you treat, it's quite important to consider using a prokinetic. Prokinetics help stimulate the migrating motor complex in the small intestine. And we have pharmaceutical and natural or herbal options. And so pharmaceutically, our options are low dose erythromycin. So that's usually around 50 or 60 milligrams per amount. Prucalopride, which has finally come to our country, and it's called Motegrity now, or you can get it from Canada. That is extremely effective and safe. And we use that usually at a half of a milligram. And there's LDN, low-dose naltrexone. That's usually used at either 2 to 4 milligrams. And then herbally, the main things we have is we have a formula, a liquid herbal formula, originally from Germany called Iberogast, that has been shown to have prokinetic effects, and also ginger. And so for ginger root, usually it's anywhere up to 1,000 to 2,000 milligrams a day. But what a lot of companies have done is put it in formula. And so I call these the ginger-containing prokinetic formulas. So we have things like Motil Pro, Motility Activator, Prokine, and there are others, of which I can't remember all the name now. I think we have five ginger-containing prokinetic formulas now. So these are other options. And they include some other ingredients that could have a potential effect on the migrating motor complex in the small intestine. So those are our options. And there you would just probably follow the label dose there. And we almost always take these at night before bed, because then we can get a good stimulation of the migrating motor complex while person sleeping. But these are things to be considered because of the concern of relapse. Because of 2/3 of cases, what we typically will do is put someone, after we treat them, and even between rounds, so like between rounds, we might be retesting, we've got to come back in and see how everything's gone, do we need another round, put someone on this to prevent backsliding while we're figuring it out. Then when we're all done, we put someone on this again to prevent relapse. The average relapse time is at about 2.5 months after eradication, so typically we'll go for about 3 months. This is just an average, you know, idea here, on a prokinetic to see has someone relapsed or not. And then if everything's fine, we might start bringing them off their prokinetic, decreasing it, and see what happens. And that's just if we don't know one way or the other. Are they going to be the 1/3 or are they going to be the 2/3? It's just mm-hmm. just to try and help the situation. There are some people that don't want to do that. That's fine. You know, if you relapse, then all right, then we know and we start looking for the underlying cause. We retreat, and then next time after that, we'll get you on a prokinetic. If somebody already knows they're chronic, they've relapsed, then you probably want to bring that in. Sure. So that's the ending part of treatment I wanted to mention. I didn't mention tons of other things, but you know, this is just
like diet. We didn't even talk about diet, which is not.
I didn't even talk about diet, my God. And how long have we been doing this podcast now? An hour at least, right?
Well, it's not expressly necessarily a treatment. It's typically more of a symptom management.
Actually, before you go on, I think Dr. Nye, you had something you wanted to toss in right about this.
I did. I actually just wanted to ask something about the prokinetics. Do you have a favorite prokinetic that you use, or like kind of a go-to for certain maybe situations or most commonly? Also, did you mention low-dose naltrexone as a prokinetic?
I don't have a favorite because I can't. I know this sounds crazy, but imagine it's like they're my children, and how would I pick between them? And I only say it like that because this is, you know, my stock and trade. This is what I do, is my entire specialty. I rely on them so heavily. I give prokinetics to everybody I see, and I can't limit myself. I have so many. I'm very individualistic in how I treat people, and so I have to customize to every person and their situation. And also I see a lot of people with sensitivities. So I often people are sensitive to things I give, and then I have to go down the list. Okay. You can't have that one. Let me use this. I mean, I think what I would say is that, prucalopride is absolutely the most effective prokinetic. Absolutely. And it also has nerve healing properties, which is exactly what we need for, post-infectious IBS, the food poisoning cause. So it has very positive side effects and benefits. So, but I don't want to say that's my favorite because I love them all.
They're all your children. speaking of, since you brought up the post-infectious IBS, I was able to find my report we were mentioning earlier, and it was the anti-vinculin antibody that came back at 1.56 and the cutoff is 1.60.
Right. So what does that mean? Right. I'd have to go into my drawer, and I'm not yet. We could talk
about it. Not prepared for it.
But it's like, so officially, no. Right. But you're suspecting maybe a little borderline. Now I can say what they've seen is people who've been exposed and time has gone by and they've had treatment, which you've had treatment. You've had good proper treatment. They see those levels fall. So it could be that you've brought them down and that's why you're not in the positive anymore.
Oh, okay. So that's interesting.
That's something I did not mention because it hasn't been enough time yet. But the researchers that you know, Dr. Pimentel and his team that have used this, they are actually using it for tracking purposes.
Got it. Okay.
We should do a part two.
That'll be exciting. Yeah, that'll be exciting to have more.
Okay, so I'm going to say something briefly on diet. The number one reason to use diet is for symptomatic control, and this becomes extremely important in chronic scenarios, like I mentioned with a scleroderma or something like that. Mm-hmm. Or if you have it takes a while to treat SIBO. We need multiple rounds. Maybe you have a mysterious underlying cause. You're working with someone, but it's going to take a while to figure it out. You know, so you bring in everything you need to help, and diet helps symptoms. So, I mean, it's fairly clear. A lot of people with SIBO, there are all these, what bothers them is carbohydrates, and carbohydrates include vegetables, fruits, you know, grains, not just sugars and sweets, right? So it's very healthy, wonderful foods. And there are some particular vegetables and fruits that are very, very common triggers for SIBO, like garlic and onions, apples, pears and stone fruits, things that people eat all the time. And if they just remove them, they notice an improvement in their symptoms. And so then they don't want to have them anymore, right? And so so then there's things like that we can do, but then we get into the difficulty of restricting and restricting. And for some people, that's absolutely necessary. But we do have to be careful. And this is where the treatment of the condition itself comes in, really, is because so many people limit their diet to control their symptoms. And what we want to do is get their diet expanded. So if we could get rid of some of that bacteria, they really shouldn't be having those symptoms, and they can expand their diet. So we have to balance this all out. Diet is incredibly helpful. I think diet has other effects too. I think a lower carbohydrate diet can be beneficial in many ways, can do all sorts of wonderful things. I think it can help reduce die-off and many other things. But we just have to be careful because of how restricted people can get. And it's also like a conditioned response, like a Pavlovian response. It's like, oh, I eat, you know, this food. I can now identify it's this food. Let's just say it's an apple or applesauce, and I get bad bloating and pain. I'm never going to eat apples again. It's just, it's like then you get afraid of the food. You get afraid of food because the food is causing your symptoms, and it's not anything, it's unconscious, you know, it's like, ow, you know, so then we develop these mental patterns that are so unfortunate, and that's where we need to get in and do our best with the condition and treating the condition.
And the underlying, the underlying issues. I definitely have personally experienced the food fear and thinking, oh, there's all these things I'm never going to be able to have again, just having so little understanding of everything that was involved with SIBO when I was first diagnosed with it. And that led to some frustrating years of dietary restriction that was probably over-restricted and not necessary. And, you know, especially when we're looking at this from a fertility perspective, which I'm hoping that most of you who are listening have listened to the podcast long enough to understand why we're talking about this topic on mastering your fertility, because there are obviously a lot of connections between gut health and fertility.
I do want to just, because I have a question in here that I'm sure a lot of our listeners will probably have in regards to SIBO, because I would imagine that there's some fear around it of if they feel like, oh, I might have SIBO, but I'm not really sure. And I'm currently trying to get pregnant. What if I get pregnant? Like, is this going to be super harmful to my baby? Am I going to be like, you know, setting them up for failure if I have SIBO when I get pregnant? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think in a perfect world, if a person could get rid of their SIBO before they got pregnant, that would be the perfect world. But we do have time constraints with, you know, with some people and things we have to think about. So that's the perfect scenario, right? It's not, to my understanding, it's not communicable in that way. Like meaning that you don't pass SIBO on because some to your baby, because they, then that the baby has to have something with their normal function of their small intestine be amiss to get the SIBO, right? So they would have to have deficient migrating motor complex. And the only way that can happen is if there's a hereditary disease that can cause that, like Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. You know, so you're giving them a genetic predisposition. So there's not that. So we can remove that fear, so to speak. Some people actually treat treat their SIBO, have treated their SIBO when they're pregnant, which I think if it's done very carefully without a lot of die-off can be okay. There are like Alimed is safe to use in pregnancy. So I've seen people do that. Certainly don't attempt that without talking to somebody who knows what they're doing. But I guess that's it. You know, it's like, it depends on what's going on in your time frame and your world. If you have the time to devote to trying to clear SIBO up, I think that would be optimal. But maybe you don't have that time. And then that doesn't mean you shouldn't try and get pregnant.
Right. Well, yeah. I think the things that need to be considered is that there are a lot of potential downstream effects from having SIBO or conditions that might have led to you developing SIBO that might also affect fertility. So, you know, if you have a co-occurrence of an autoimmune condition, or, you know, you're dealing with significant nutrient deficiencies because that overgrowth of bacteria is causing malabsorption, or, you know, you're have a very restricted diet, which is going to potentially be nutrient deficient. I think those are really where my big concerns are with SIBO, and why I would want to address it preconception is because of the potential for like epigenetic effects, which we don't know. Like, what are the epigenetic effects of having SIBO and potentially having some, you know, compromised nutrient pathways and deficiencies? I mean, there are a lot of potential considerations. So I agree with Dr. Seebecker. In a perfect world, we would address this before getting pregnant. But I also don't want people to be afraid that they can't have healthy babies, or that there's absolutely no possible chance of having like a normal child if you have SIBO while you're pregnant.
Conception, you know?
Yeah,
right, exactly.
The reality is that you do what you can do with the information that you have. So if you know that you're positive for this before you get pregnant, do what you can in your time frame to address it beforehand if you can. You know, see somebody who is experienced with addressing this during pregnancy if your symptoms are severe and you have major concerns about your baby's health or your health during pregnancy as a result of having SIBO. And then, you know, if something isn't quite right or something's off with baby, or there are some nutrient deficiencies or epigenetic effects, there are some amazing doctors that can help you address those things.
Yeah.
Your baby is not like done for life because you had SIBO while you were pregnant, even if there are
problems. No, absolutely not. And I think I'm also asked that question because I too got pregnant, you know, and I have chronic SIBO. I have probably this anti-vegan thing I have to deal with, but and I got pregnant right after I did an elemental diet. Now, I'm not saying everybody should go out and do an elemental diet and that's it.
Yeah, it's really a pretty good time. You're quite clear, you know?
But yeah, exactly. And I really did talk previously on the podcast that I feel like that was part of the reason I was able to get pregnant and actually have a fairly healthy pregnancy. That's my own personal story. But I guess what I'm getting at is like, if you already know that you have chronic IBS, maybe you're something like Kristen and I, where we've had it, and you, Allison, where you've had it like such a long time through your childhood and through your teens, that you can treat it. And you might not completely get rid of it, but you can do your best to like get to a state of health for your own personal situation. And then try to conceive at that point too. So I just wouldn't be totally scared that, you know, that you're going to do your baby harm if this is something that you know that you have or that you're dealing with.
Yeah. And one follow-up comment to that is that when we talk about chronic and relapses, the most important thing to understand if a person is experiencing this, is that chronic doesn't mean that you're going to feel as bad as you do at your worst all the time. In fact, the symptom, I guess, prognosis is very, very good. We tend to get people that we treat for SIBO 90% better, 80 to 90% better. So like they're like living symptom free. That what the chronic means at that point is that you do things to maintain feeling that good. And I know that can be very, very upsetting to think about at the start. But from my perspective, having had it since I was five, I look around and I'm like, well, who doesn't have something that they have to manage, whether it's health or family, or like life is chronic. I mean, do you know what I'm
life
saying?
Life is chronic. I love that.
I mean, you know, it's like we all have our, like, okay, there's whether it's your always health something or there, a troubled relationship or financial troubles, we all have things that are not perfect that we do, but then we work to make better, and then we do things to maintain them staying better. And so it's like, of course I don't want someone to have that, but let's just take a moment to step into our adult selves for a second. And it's like, this is, we can handle that, you know, like you, if you're feeling 90% better, but you just have to take some supplements or a little bit of lifestyle to maintain that, that's then join the rest of everything else that's like that.
That's pretty good, really. I mean, I have things like that where I'm like, hey, if I could just get to this point where I can, you know, eat this type of a diet, which is an all-inclusive, but is doable for me long-term and like some supplemental support for digestion, like, cool. I'm good.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
all about perspective too.
As we wrap things up, because I know we're probably exhausting everybody talking about SIBO for over an hour. But as we wrap up, I do want to just give you an opportunity to tell us a little bit about this new course that you are putting out. And this is focused on teaching practitioners. And I know that a lot of you listening are not practitioners, but I know that a lot of you listening probably are as well. We know we have a nice audience of different types of practitioners listening to the podcast. So just tell us a little bit about what you have put together.
Well, yes, I actually have a course for patients and a course for practitioners.
Oh, awesome.
And the course for patients is actually, it's got both things going on in it, which is that, look, if you don't have anyone to help you, here's the information you need, but it also has a lot of information of how to work with your practitioner. It's just really trying to, it's not trying to supplant a practitioner or a doctor. It's just trying to educate. Right. Knowledge is power. So we've got that, that course for patients, and then for practitioners, it's called the SIBO. Well, the patient one's called SIBO Recovery Roadmap, and then the practitioner one is called SIBO Pro Course, Pro for Professionals, and it's actually a thorough class. So it's about 22 hours long, and I've gotten it. Continuing medical education is available for 20 of those hours for those who need or can use that type of credit, and we just go through everything thoroughly, and I keep the video classes. It's online, so it's video classes. I keep them pretty short so you can fit them around your schedule, you know, like 10 or 15 minute classes, because I know we all have trouble fitting in this extra education. And I've got it in two formats. One is called self-study for people who just sort of want a hands-off approach, and then I've got interactive. And with that, you have office hours with me where we can go over cases and questions. And we have wonderful, wonderful groups of physicians who take this class. And so we certainly crowdsource, and it's very, very helpful. We ask, you know, oh, what does someone else have to say? Wonderful sessions. So that's it. And I really, really hope people will consider this kind of education, because like just hearing Dr. Nye, what you said, like your initial education versus your more thorough education, it really can help clear up troubling, mysterious things and just help you to be more effective, mm-hmm. and help you particularly to think underneath the condition and find underlying causes and I think be much more effective practitioner. And cool. you know, you'll have a link in somewhere you'll post for people.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you guys are
well, and what you were saying earlier was that a lot of practitioners are feeling that SIBO is bunk and that they're like, I don't even know how to treat this. Like it's not working. There must be something else. And a lot of that just has to do with maybe their initial training of how they're treating is they need to understand that it's such a rapidly evolving field. Research is coming out all the time
we get brand new information, certainly every year. And so I've got all the newest information in this course, and I'm going to have to completely update it by spring.
Yeah.
Wow. It's just that's incredible.
Amazing. That is commitment, Dr. Seebecker.
It takes a lot, let me tell you.
We appreciate having somebody like you in the field that is really providing this level of education to practitioners. I've personally learned a lot from you. I know Haley has as well. So, you know, thank you so much for creating this type of a resource. We will have that linked in the episode description as well as in the show notes for the podcast. And thank you so much for being here and sharing this. I know we could have probably talked for like two more hours about all this stuff. We just barely scratched the surface with diet. So maybe we'll have to have you back on and do like a part two SIBO diet options and troubleshooting, because that's a big thing too. But thank you so much for sharing everything that you did today. I think this is going to be very empowering for patients who might be going through this right now. Mm-hmm. So we appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you.